The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Anthony Chibadirwe, and I'm substituting today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. We are coming to you live from our KPCG studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. Today, we'll talk about the Arab Spring that could break out in the Red Sea nation of Sudan. We'll also talk about Operation Inherent Resolve, and that's obviously the American-led military intervention against the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. And we'll also talk about some of the crises that are plaguing South Africa. And we will conclude by discussing an important textbook on geopolitics that we use quite a lot here at The Trumpet. It's a very insightful textbook that actually has many answers to a lot of the problems that we face in our world. Thanks for joining me for the first Trumpet Daily Radio Show of 2019. And what a year 2019 is going to be. Yesterday on the Trumpet Daily, Mr. Stephen Fleury concluded with a powerful montage of news clips that essentially summarized the year of 2018. It summarized the big important news of the year. And if you missed it, I strongly recommend that you go back and just try to listen to it, because if we want to get a better understanding of what 2019 is going to be, we need a better understanding of what 2018 was. Just like what Winston Churchill said, if you want to get a better understanding of the future, we need to look back in the past. So if you missed that, I strongly encourage you to listen to it. The year 2019 is going to be, quote, a year on the edge, end quote. That's how a think tank called Geopolitical Futures summarized its forecast of 2019. This is what it wrote in its introduction. History is never as neatly demarcated as we like to think it is. We bookmark certain years in our memories to separate what came before from what came after. We remember 2008 for a financial crisis that nearly sank the global economy. We remember 1991 as the year the Cold War ended. We remember 1939 as the moment Nazi Germany began its ill-fated quest for global domination. These years are important because they changed the world for generations to come, but they are no more important than the years that preceded them. For it was in these years that the social, economic, and political conditions that fomented change were created. To borrow a quote from Jacob Riis, who was an American Danish journalist, it's never the final hammer blow that breaks the rock. It is all the hammer blows that came before it. For our 2019 forecast, this is Geopolitical Futures continuing. For our 2019 forecast, we will identify the blows that came before. Many of the forces that will shape the world in 2019 shaped the world in prior years. What makes this year different is that all the events and elections and conflicts that we would identify as a matter of course lead to one inescapable conclusion. One era is ending and another will soon begin. The global economic system is starting to sputter. The United States, still the world's dominant power, has spread itself thin, and the power gap between it and its rivals has narrowed. Conventional wisdom is no longer conventional. And around the world, there is a sense that everything, including U.S. hegemony, is in question. The coming year, then, can best be described as a year on the edge, a transition between the post-Cold War era and a new era that has yet to be defined. It is the kind of year that will seem remarkable only in hindsight, a moment in time when pent-up forces and countless events take us past the point of no return. It will be a year of anxiety, suspicion, and fear of what the future holds as countries seek to delay the onset of crises they cannot avoid. Wow. I thought that was very remarkable. I thought that was very insightful analysis. And some of the language that they used there is similar to the language that we've used on Trumpet Daily, on the Trumpet Hour, and at thetrumpet.com. They write that 2019 will be a moment in time when pent-up forces and countless events take us past the point of no return. It will be a year of anxiety, suspicion, and fear of what the future holds as countries seek to delay the onset of crises they cannot avoid. Again, that's not coming from thetrumpet.com. It's coming instead from a company that believes that things like geography, demography, resource scarcity, military capability, and such, it believes that these are the primary forces that actually govern world leaders. It believes that when you understand the power in these impersonal forces, you'll be able to understand what it is that compels and constrains a world leader. And when you know what compels and constrains a leader, you can predict how the nation they lead will behave. And when you know how nations behave, you can anticipate how the international system will change. I was actually just paraphrasing their website there. And they are really good at what they do, but they do not factor in God and Bible prophecy. They talk very eloquently and fairly accurately about these impersonal forces like geography, demography, resource scarcity, military capability. But again, they do not factor in God, because God is the one who shaped geography and he has full control over it. He says in the Bible that he has given the nations their inheritance, and that he has determined the boundaries of our habitations. It says that he rules in the kingdoms of men, and that he gives them to whomsoever he wills, even the basest or lowliest of men. He says that he makes nations great and destroys them. He says he enlarges nations and sends them away. He says that he determines outcomes of wars. He provides rain and the so-called natural resources that we all have. And in Isaiah 46 and verse 10, he says that he declares the end from the beginning. In other words, he prophesies. And he says, "My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." He is the one big factor that makes the trumpet different from geopolitical futures or any other think tank or news source out there, no matter how insightful it might be. A few weeks ago, I printed myself a big stack of articles that we've written so far about the main trends that we follow based on Bible prophecy. And if you'd like to do the same, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the trends tab on the right-hand corner. on the top. There are about 15 articles so far, and we are working on producing more. And I did the math. The average trend article could take you just 20 minutes to read. 20 minutes to get this sweeping overview of these big trends that we watch, explaining the history, some of the geography, and the scriptures, most importantly, the scriptures about these events and about where they are taking us, about the future, in just 20 minutes. And in 6 hours of reading, you'll be done with all of them. So I'd like to encourage you to visit the trends section of our website. Those articles really help provide a big picture overview of the major geopolitical prophecies that you need to be aware of. Now, one of the biggest news of the past few weeks has been President Donald Trump's announcement that he will withdraw American troops from Syria and the subsequent resignation of Defense Secretary James Mattis over the issue. And of course, we've been hearing some developments lately about how he's slowing that down. But yeah, this became quite a big deal in the past few weeks. And of course, the United States has been in Syria as part of Operation Inherent Resolve, whose stated purpose was to fight a relatively small group of terrorists that was waving a black flag and conquering a vast amount of territory, robbing central banks, stealing tanks and weapons from national armies, selling off girls and women as sex slaves, decapitating people, drowning caged captives in swimming pools, burning prisoners alive in front of cameras, and encouraging their supporters anywhere in the world to terrorize anyone who didn't share the same radical Islamist beliefs they did. Defeating those terrorists was the main goal. So, has the Islamic State been completely defeated? Well, no. In 2016, we wrote an article titled "The Islamic State of Mind," in which we acknowledged the imminent demise of the Islamic State Caliphate. In that article, we quoted an Islamic State spokesman who said, quote, "True defeat is the loss of willpower and desire to fight," end quote. And that's true. Anything short of that will never be true, complete, absolute defeat. And besides that, there have just been multiple reports recently about atrocities that the Islamic State still is committing. So, has it been completely defeated? No. But having said that, has the Islamic State been largely defeated? Well, I'll probably say yes to that. I think that it has already lost about 99% of the territory that it had. And one of the main reasons why President Trump's withdrawal from Syria has been such a controversial issue is actually not so much about the Islamic State, but about the other threats in the region that are much bigger than the Islamic State, if you can believe it. Listen to Senator Marco Rubio discussing some of those threats. Here's clip one.
So why is this happening? Who are the winners here of all this? Well, let me tell you, I think that the one winner here has been Erdogan. He has absolutely played us on this. It's truly stunning. He has spent months pressuring the United States to abandon the Kurds. Diplomatically and phone calls to the president, to others, he's spent months, and he's been doing that pressure on the one side while also threatening military action on the other. In essence, saying, I'm coming in to Syria, the Turks, and I'm going after the YPG, the Kurds, And I know U.S. troops are embedded alongside them. You guys should be careful because we're coming in. He's been doing this for months. And the goal of it the whole time was to separate the United States from the Kurds, to get us to break up this arrangement that we had with them to fight ISIS. And it worked. He has achieved it. It's truly unbelievable that he has been able to get us to back down.
He then proceeded to talk about the complications that would arise if, say, Turkey attacked some of our allies in the region, given Turkey's NATO's status, they could invoke Article 5 and it would just cause a lot of problems. And then he went on to discuss other threats. I have a clip that I'll play for you. It's rather lengthy, but I think he makes some good points worth playing to you. So here's clip two.
Who's the other big winner? Russia. In fact, their embassy here in the U.S. has already put out a tweet celebrating the decision. Why? Well, first of all, because America's now out. At some point, people are going to have to sit down and decide what is the future of a post-ISIS Syria. And you know who's going to be at that table? The Turks are going to be at that table, because they're going to have a military presence in northern Syria. The Iranians are going to be at the table because they're the closest allies Assad has. Assad will be at the table, and Putin will be at the table. Guess who won't be at the table? The United States of America. And so Vladimir Putin, of course he's celebrating this decision, because America basically walked away, gave up its seat at the table. We have no presence there any longer. And we have just turned over this country and its future and its meaning in the region to Vladimir Putin and Iran and Assad. Also, he's another reason why Putin is a big winner is because you can just imagine those meetings now. When Putin goes to the Middle East and meets with the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Jordanians, frankly, even the Israelis, you know what he's going to say to them? He's going to say to them, I don't know why you're counting on America. I don't know why you are relying on America. They're unreliable. Vladimir Putin's going to say, look at me. I stood by Assad. Even after the whole world came after him, I stood by him. I didn't retreat. Look at America. They abandoned these Kurds to be slaughtered by the Turks and maybe by the regime. And you are going to put the future and security of your country in the hands of an unreliable and erratic partner like the United States? It's a huge victory for Putin in that regard. And by the way, put yourself in the position of the Kurds, facing an onslaught from the Turkish military. You've now given them two choices. They can partner up with Russia as their protector against Turkey, or they can partner up with the regime and Iran. That's the choice we've left them with. Who's the other big winner in all this? Is Iran and Hezbollah. For a long time, Assad has allowed Iran to use Syria as a transit point to arm Hezbollah in Lebanon so Lebanon can threaten and attack Israel. They will now be able to step up those efforts. There is no U.S. presence in Syria. There is no U.S. seat at the table. And you can fully expect that Iran is going to step up their engagement in Syria with Hezbollah. And let me tell you why that's a problem. I'll get to that in a moment. It has to do with Israel. But here's the bottom line. You can fully expect now that Iran is going to step up its own presence through the IRGC and through Hezbollah and through the militias that they've empowered in the region right on the border with Israel. Iran now has the ability to put weaponry and killers right across the Golan Heights, right on the border with Israel. The other big winner in all of this, of course, is Hezbollah. As I said, they now have expanded their area and their supply route.
Again, remember, this is a war that was primarily about eliminating the Islamic State. And yes, the Islamic State hasn't been eliminated completely yet, but there have been a lot of gains that have been made. And when President Trump announced the withdrawal from Syria, all the talk, it seems, was primarily about some of the other threats other than the Islamic State. That's why I'm bringing this up. Here's what Senator Lindsey Graham and five of his colleagues, including Senator Rubio, wrote to President Trump over this matter on December 19. Quote, ISIS is not the only threat. the brutal dictatorship of Bashar Assad, that's the Syrian president, the brutal dictatorship of Bashar Assad continues to weigh heavily upon the Syrian people, and we fear that a withdrawal of our troops may embolden Bashar Assad to take further actions to solidify his power. The withdrawal of American presence from Syria also bolsters two other adversaries to the United States, Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia have used the Syrian conflict as a stage to magnify their influence in the region. The letter continues, any sign of weakness perceived by Iran or Russia will only result in their increased presence in the region and a decrease in the trust of our partners and allies. In October, a top U.S. commander for the Middle East, General Joseph Votel, he said, quote, we don't have a counter-Iranian mission here. We have a defeat ISIS mission. But I do recognize that our presence, our development of partners, and relationships down there does have an indirect effect on some malign activities that Iran and their various proxies and surrogates would like to pursue down here. And I know that some of these matters have been covered already on the Trumpet Daily and on the Trumpet Hour, but here's the big question that now needs to be asked and answered. Why did the United States not have a counter-Iranian mission in the Middle East in the first place? If one of the biggest concerns about an American withdrawal from Operation Inherent Resolve in Syria is Iran, then why wasn't countering Iran clearly defined as a big part of that operation in the first place? Now, it might seem like an insignificant point, but the fact is that clearly defining the real enemy in any war is very important. Think about the war on terror. Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote an article in March of 2009 titled The War with No Name. And in it, he said, quote, by definition, the war on terror was always a misnomer. You can't fight a war against a military tactic without identifying the people and the ideology behind it. But that's exactly what the United States and Britain embarked upon after 9/11. Then President George Bush said before Congress, our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. Mr. Stephen Fleury continues, as we have written from the beginning, it should have begun with radical Islam, headed by Iran, the world's leading state sponsor of international terrorism. But because of politically correct paralysis and reluctance to offend an entire religious movement, the U.S. government opted for a fuzzy definition. To be fair, though, President Bush did identify Iran as one of three nations in the axis of evil. He also told Congress that the war would not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Unbelievably, Mr. Fleury continues, these words now seem as bluster. Cowboy diplomacy. Today, the force of appeasement in the United States and Britain is so strong that even the term war on terror is considered inappropriate and unnecessarily offensive. End quote. Now, he wrote that during the Obama presidency, yes, but the fact is, directly identifying the Iranian threat and doing something directly about it has not been one of our strong points, apparently. In February 2015, when ISIS or the Islamic State was at its peak, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury made some remarkable statements which, if more people had listened to and pondered, the United States, I'm sure, would have been much better off today. And he based those statements not merely on geography or demography or resource scarcity or military capability, but primarily on Bible prophecy. Here's clip 3.
In recent news, you heard about the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians who were beheaded by ISIS just before they were beheaded, saying, "Jesus, help me." And all 21 of them were in a bloody massacre. Now, if you look at these Egyptian Christians, they were just going there to try to find work for their families. And so it's quite a pitiful story. But there is a U.S. general who said that the face of radical Islam is now ISIS. But I disagree with that strongly. The face of radical Islam is still Iran many times over, and the Bible tells you that, because Iran is the king of the South or the Middle East. But also history tells us that. And just the what is happening on the world scene tells us that even right now.
Iran is the king of the South. Iran is the biggest threat in the Middle East right now. And the prophecy Mr. Gerald Fleury refers to there is found in Daniel 11, verse 40 through 43. It identifies Iran as the nation which leads and sponsors and inspires Islamic terrorism. There are about 80 million Shiites in Iran, and about 85% of them, including most, if not all, of Iran's leaders, believe in the doctrine of the hidden 12th Imam or the Mahdi. They believe in some sort of a second coming of this 12th Imam, and they believe that this individual, this 12th Imam, will return sooner if his staunch followers cause more apocalyptic chaos and violence, the likes of which will destroy one third of the world's population and another third as a result of hunger and disease and social unrest. And finally, that destruction will be capped with the annihilation of the Jewish state and the killing of all infidels, after which they say the seed of Islam will be planted in the four corners of the earth. The Islamic State shares similar beliefs. And while the Islamic State still has the potential to inspire so-called lone wolf attacks, it's not anywhere close to where Iran is. Iran has a huge army. By comparison, it has a formidable air force. It's testing ballistic missiles, and it's pursuing nuclear weapons. The prophecy in Daniel tells us that Iran will create and inspire so much chaos that other nations will respond with brutal force. And the prophecy reveals that the United States will largely be out of the picture at that point. Mr. Gerald Fleury has written a book about it all, and it's titled The King of the South. He'll be very happy to have it mailed to you for free if you ask for it at td@kpcg.fm. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and you can get the live stream at kpcg.fm and also at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments or feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Oh my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
The Trumpet Daily.
There's a potential Arab Spring that's taking place right now in the North African nation of Sudan. And Sudan, by the way, is nestled between Egypt to its north and the so-called Horn of Africa to its south, and there is the Red Sea on its eastern border. The country has been recovering from a devastating civil war, which resulted in the country splitting in two in 2011. It's been going through a severe foreign exchange crisis and high inflation. And 2 weeks ago, the Sudanese government hiked the prices of bread and fuel, and that instantly sparked protests across the nation. The protests have continued to this day, and the protesters are not just demanding that the prices of bread and fuel be reduced. They are now demanding the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir, who has been their leader for 30 years now. Doctors have gone on strike to express their solidarity with the protesters, and thousands of those protesters have attempted to march toward the presidential palace to demand al-Bashir's resignation, but they've clashed with security forces. And those forces have dispersed them with tear gas, stun grenades, and even live ammunition. And over the past weeks, at least 37 people have reportedly been killed, and some say that that number could be as high as 60. And these protesters have been chanting slogans like, "Revolution is the people's choice." So, is an Arab Spring imminent in Sudan? Well, African dictators are not typically taken down very easily, but anything is possible, and it's something we need to keep our eyes on. Geopolitical Futures has had an article about this titled, "A Newfound Interest in Sudan's Unrest." I'll read some of it to you. It wrote, "Sudan is no stranger to civil unrest. Over the past 70 years, it has weathered two civil wars and a third conflict resulting in its partition, hence South Sudan. But this time, it's likely that certain regional powers, namely Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt, are paying close attention to the outcome." It continues, "Sudan's strategic value stems from two geographical features, its Red Sea coast and the convergence of the White and Blue Nile rivers. The Red Sea coastline has proved alluring to Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, while Sudan's control of the Nile's northward flow is of interest to its northern neighbor, Egypt, which is highly dependent on that source of water. When al-Bashir came to power, he signed a defense agreement with Iran, giving Iran a foothold on either side of Saudi Arabia. Iran proceeded to build weapons factories in Sudan, and it is believed that Israel targeted some of these factories in airstrikes in 2009, 2012, and 2015, concerned as it was that the weapons would be shipped to Hezbollah in Lebanon, via North Africa and the Mediterranean. But as Iran spreads itself too thin, Sudan has fallen on its list of priorities. Then it talks about, the article goes on to talk about the economic challenges Sudan has been facing. And then it says, Sudan's need for foreign investment was an opportunity for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia injected volumes of capital that Iran simply couldn't afford, effectively buying Sudan's alliance. Sudan's defection to Saudi Arabia was undoubtedly part of the motivation for the United States to lift long-standing sanctions on Sudan at the end of 2017, although it did so claiming that Sudan had made strides in abandoning terrorism. Now, I think it's important to remember Sudan's shady past, its shady history, its terrorist ties. It was Sudan under President Omar al-Bashir that provided a safe haven for Osama bin Laden from 1992 to 1996, right before he set up his base in Afghanistan. So we do need to continue to watch this Red Sea area. We need to watch what's happening in Sudan. This area is very strategic. It's an important trading region. And there are a lot of players that want to gain a lot of influence in that region. The Geopolitical Futures article goes on to talk about Egypt, how it's trying to meddle in Sudan. It also talks about Turkey, and Turkey already has been given access by Sudan to an important base, an important island that is now being converted into a Turkish base right there on the Red Sea coastline. It's a territory that belongs to Sudan. So we need to just continue watching what's happening over there. Continue to watch Egypt. Continue to watch Turkey. Watch Saudi Arabia. And more importantly, watch Iran. We soon will have a new trend article explaining why the Trumpet watches Iran gaining a chokehold on critical sea gates and on maritime trading routes in this region, and that includes this Red Sea area. Its influence in Yemen already gives it a lot of power in that region, and the ties it has with Sudan and the ties that it could continue building with Sudan could become very significant in light of Bible prophecy. We'll take another quick break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
I mentioned earlier about a book of on geopolitics that we're going to that we use a lot here, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But right now, I have a couple of articles about South Africa, and I'm going to read a few excerpts from them. The first one is from News One. And the title says, South Africa race war feared in the new year as tensions rise between blacks and whites. The article begins, the heightened tensions between black and white South Africans could explode into an all-out race war in the new year if things keep up at the current pace. While anger has already simmered after the dispute over farming land, a reported policy to, quote, not allow black people, end quote, who might be, quote unquote, criminals at one of the country's public beaches was likely worsening citizens' already bad relations. And here's another one. This is from The Telegraph. And this is what it says. A picturesque South African beach has been embroiled in a bitter racism row over a local security firm allegedly turned away black bathers from the area, prompting protesters to ritually slaughter a sheep on its sands to ward off prejudice. Security guards working on Clifton Beach in Cape Town allegedly told black citizens to leave the site 2 days before Christmas in a bid to keep criminals away from the droves of tourists who visit each year. In response, a group of protesters slaughtered a sheep on the beach in a ritual supposed to ward off racism, while others sang and burned incense. Beaches, along with many other public areas, were segregated under white minority apartheid rule and have since been a flashpoint of racial tension in South Africa. The mayor of Cape Town has denied the security firm was only asking black residents to leave the beach and that it did not single out any race groups. The article continues, says that meanwhile, the chief executive of the security company said the company's guards did not close the beach and were only trying to protect local residents from criminal activity which had caused mayhem in the area. However, Chumani Maxwele, hope I pronounced that correctly, a local activist, said the guards had deliberately told black people on the beach to live. This activist, by the way, is the one who actually planned the slaughter of an animal at the beach. And when I saw his name, I was reminded of the first time that I heard of him. And that was in March of 2015. He was on the campus grounds of the University of Cape Town on March 9th. And you know what he did? Well, there was this statue of a British colonialist named Cecil Rhodes. And on this one day, he approached that statue, and in his hand was a bucket of human excrement, and he flung it over that statue. The statue of British colonialist Cecil John Rhodes. Obviously, He despite this British colonialist, and he's not the only one. In fact, protesters ended up destroying that statue, at least having that statue removed from the campus from the University of Cape Town, which was built by funds that were donated by Cecil John Rhodes. We wrote about this in an article back in 2005, and we talked about Cecil Rhodes being a British colonialist who wanted to expand the British Empire in Africa. And in that article, we quoted from a book titled Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power by Niall Ferguson. And Mr. Ferguson, he wrote this in the book. The difficulty with the achievements of empire is that they are much more likely to be taken for granted than the sins of the empire. Now, Ferguson does not claim that the British Empire was perfect and without blemish, because it wasn't. He acknowledged this, quote, "The empire was never so altruistic. In the 18th century, the British were indeed as zealous in the acquisition and exploitation of slaves as they were subsequently zealous in trying to stamp out slavery. And for much longer, they practiced forms of racial discrimination and segregation that we today consider abhorrent. When imperial authority was challenged in India, Jamaica, and South Africa, the British response was brutal. Yet," Ferguson continues, "the fact remains that no organization in history has done more to promote free movement of goods, capital, and labor than the British Empire in the 19th and earliest 20th centuries." He continues, "and no organization has done more to impose Western norms of law, order, and governance around the world." And I think that that's just a very important perspective to have when thinking about the British Empire. I think a lot of these protests that we see all around the world, they seem to lack just this this basic understanding. And this is where the book that you heard advertised, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, comes in. This book clarifies all of that. It does not claim that the British Empire or the United States is perfect. It does not claim that. It explains why these nations are where they are today. And it all has to do with promises that God made thousands of years ago to Abraham. And God had to fulfill those promises in this time. These are the nations of Israel. And they are not God's favorite nation. And this is not to say that everything that the United States or that the British have done has been, it's not to say that God signed off on everything that these nations did, but it is to say that these nations have been blessed, not because of what their citizens have done, but because of a promise that God made thousands of years ago that he had to fulfill. And that perspective is just so important to understand the world today. I believe just understanding that will just help eliminate a lot of the racial tension that we find in this world. Here I am. I am a black man from Zimbabwe, and I am promoting the United States and Britain in Prophecy because it's not a racist book. It's about the awesome God who keeps promises. And I'm grateful that I'm here in the United States because I am benefiting a lot from those promises, those blessings that God has given to these nations. And I'd like to really strongly encourage that you, if you don't have it, request this book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. As you probably heard, more than 6 million people have requested this book. And if you're not one of those people, if you're not one of those 6 million people, you need to get this book. So do request The United States and Britain Prophecy. It's a powerful book. Just imagine if even the nations of this world, imagine if they understood the truth in this book. Right now, there's a lot of competition among nations. Nations want to take the United States' place as the leading nation in this world, as the superpower nation. And they believe they can accomplish that through perhaps trade wars or real wars, whatever it is, it might be. But they do not realize that the United States is where it is because of God, because of the promises that God made. If they want to get there, they need to be recipients of similar blessings from God. So just understanding that, I think, could even help with not just with race issues, but even with geopolitics. So it is a very important book, and we'll be making a lot of, we'll be writing a lot of articles and producing a lot of materials to promote this book, including a documentary, maybe in the next weeks or months. So do stay tuned to The Trumpet Daily, thetrumpet.com, and we'll be talking a whole lot more about that. Thanks a lot for joining us today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury, will be back to you. We'll be back with you tomorrow. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Have a wonderful day.